Farm of Madness I've shared a few times, so it's a great pleasure to introduce Tom W.
My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. Zowie, as we say in Berkeley. Stuff about me. I'm almost 41 years old. I haven't had to drink or use in about 11 years and 5 months, but who's counting? I'm a Catholic priest. I have been ordained on April 1st. It will be 10 years. And I'm doing what I like to do. Some people I know get in kinds of work they hate, and I find I really like the way I live and who I live with and the kind of work I do and the quality of my contact with people. And that's only possible due to recovery and from the disease of alcoholism. I don't know how else I could have ended up here. I don't have a great drunkalogue. I'm very impressed with people who do, but I just don't. The story of my drinking is depression, and I was depressed for years, most of my 20s, and I just couldn't. I was fine as long as I was moving, but as soon as I stopped moving, I couldn't move again, and it was one of those things. And I tried staying very, very busy so I could do a lot of things, and then I could do nothing, kind of a little manic depressive. I didn't have a lot of living skills outside of bluff and bravado and trying to look good or at least looking mean enough to not be bothered with. Towards the end of my drinking, I kind of crashed and burned in Berkeley. And where I used to go over to San Francisco to the Tenderloin and just kind of prowl. And I was one of the people that other people moved away from. So I never had, they say, weren't you afraid of going there? No, no one tried to mug me, I assure you. I started drinking pretty young. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I thought I knew a lot about alcohol. I was young enough to think that mixing bourbon and Hershey syrup was a good idea. Some of you have had worse. And if you paid $5 for it in a fancy place like this, they'd call it a Brandy Alexander, you know. So, what's the problem? I never saw the great alcoholic films until I was way into my sobriety. In fact, I have yet to sit through Days of Wine and Roses for the entire thing. I get so nervous halfway through it. But he convinces her to start drinking, and her first drink were Brandy Alexander's too. So I felt a little too close for comfort. Both of my parents did have alcohol around the house. We were kind of a drinking family. My drinking was abnormal, but a lot of my drinking was private too, so it wasn't my public example. Eighth grade, seventh grade, came home from school, was fixing myself lunch, fixed myself a tequila milkshake. That's not the abnormal part yet. I think a lot of people would be curious, you know, and it's ice cream and tequila, and you put it in a blender, and you zip it up, and you drink it. And I took one mouthful of it, and I said, this really tastes like shit. And I drank the whole thing. That's the abnormal part. Okay. lots of stuff like that. Alcohol really worked for me. When I was a kid, I was one of those very bright kids that was kind of embarrassed with the gifts God had given me. I spoke languages easily. I was pretty literary. I could read and write. And what I wanted to do instead was be real physical and, you know, throw passes and dribble balls. And I tried all of it, and I was just absolutely incompetent. But there was one area that I was real good at, and that was drinking. And any questions about my masculinity or adulthood or maturity were erased when we started drinking. Because I had a tremendous capacity for booze very quickly. And I was able to drink guys 2 and 3 times my size under the table. It was wonderful. I would drive them home. I would, you know, be calmly talking about what it all means or something, and they'd be throwing up. And I knew that I was more of a man than they were because of stuff like that. Now, the fact is, tremendous tolerance to alcohol is a sign of abnormal reaction to alcohol. Normal people, when they have a couple of drinks too many, pass out or throw up. I would just start to get interested, you know. And my tremendous, and you get a lot of social praise. Boy, Tom can really hold his booze. So it kind of reinforces it, but the fact was, doing that is like telling someone with tuberculosis that they cough real well. And, see you cough well. Where's the book? Oh, there's the book. I was going through the big book the other day. I do this erratically. I wish I had a more ordered life, but I really don't. There's almost nothing I do every day in a row. And I knew that I had to get a copy of the book in early sobriety, and I got one. But then, you know, you have to read it. At least that's what they implied. And I really tried to do this. I never read Roman numerals, so I skipped right away to page 1. And it started, war fever ran high in the New England town, you know. Dull, 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 dull. To which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. I mean, how, page after page after page. So I would just get to the point of absolute boredom and put the book down and figure, well, when I'm a little more sober. So I'd wait a week or two or a month, and I'd try it again on page 1. And I found out that, for me, that's not how I can read the book. It's not a novel that you start on page 1 till you find out who did it. So what I began doing was opening the book in odd places and then read for 5 pages. I can take about 5 pages. Read about 5 pages and make notes, you know, and things like that. And it's amazing when I do that how the book changes. You know, things I've read before, someone rewrote it in the past year or two. I was doing this a while ago and I stumbled across what I think is a part of the book we should set to music. It's in the stories entitled He Had to Be Shown. I love titles like that. And here's what he said. High school kid stuff. That's what this is. That's why I... He said, when I was 18 at the end of high school, the high school team had a banquet at a well-known roadhouse outside of Akron. Roadhouse. They mean a bar, okay? But when you're this old, it's a roadhouse. We boys drove out in somebody's car, and I went to the bar on the way to the dining room. And we all did. We all went to the bar. And I, in an effort to impress the other boys that I was city bred, having lived in Scranton and Cleveland. That's very funny. Asked them if they didn't want to drink. They looked at one another queerly. Right in the book. And finally, one of them allowed he'd have a beer. And they all followed him, each of them saying he'd have a beer too. I ordered a martini extra dry. I didn't even know what a martini looked like. But I had heard a man down the bar order one. That was my first drink. Can you imagine? Wonderful. I kept watching the man down the bar to see what he did with a contraption like that, and he just smelled of his drink and set it down again. So I did the same. He took a couple of puffs of a cigarette, and I took a couple of puffs of my cigarette. He tossed off half his martini. I tossed off half of mine, and it nearly blew the top of my head off. It irritated my nostrils. I choked. I didn't like it. There was nothing about that drink that I liked. But I watched him, and he tossed off the rest of his, so I tossed off the rest of mine. He ate his olive. And I ate mine. I didn't even like the olive. It was repulsive to me from every standpoint. And then he says, and this is what I love him for, I drank 9 martinis in less than an hour. I really understand that. That makes perfect sense to me. A little while ago, a year or two or three ago, I have no sense of the past. It was either this morning or 10 years ago. I have no idea. It must be the gin. But in the last 5 years, I know, I went to a hospital with a physician in San Francisco who's been sober forever, a tough French Canadian named Gil. And he and I were doing a presentation to non-alcoholics, good, decent people who work in hospitals, chaplains, nurses, you know, decent, hard-working folk. And we, the doctor and the priest, who were both bad drunks, were trying to explain crazy alcoholism to people who were non-alcoholics. Now, this is difficult. And you try to explain things, and you think they get the point, and then they ask a question, and it's clear they've missed everything. Example, we were talking about symptoms of the disease and the 12 steps and AA and recovery and spirituality and the physiology of how it works in livers and enzymes, all that stuff. And one of the people there said, well, you know, if someone starts to show symptoms of alcoholism, why can't we just sit them down and explain this to them? Why can't they just say no? She said, isn't that possible? That would make great sense to me. And Gil thought for a second and said, no. He said, because alcoholism, she has three phases. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when you're having fun. And when you're having fun, no one can tell you to stop. You know, I think most folks don't realize, at least how fun it really was for a long time. It was sensational. It was more fun than anything I'd ever done in the whole world, and it made me feel sensational. I mean, booze really worked for me. When I was a skinny 16-year-old with a lot of doubts about a lot of things, all I would have to do is have a couple of drinks, and I put on 20 pounds in my arms and shoulders, and my voice got a lot deeper, and I became real secure and could talk to people who were bigger than me. It was wonderful. You see, fun. Phase two. Fun plus problems. This is when it's still fun, but you start to have problems. And then he said, phase three, problems. He said, some people in phase three get well, but until they get to phase three, they don't want to get well, you see? So what to do, he said, get out of their way so they can get through the fun phase fast. Now, the embarrassing truth is, if alcohol still worked for me, I'd still be using it. You know, I'm not here because it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, my life would improve if I cut back on my drinking. I'd have better relationships and more self-respect, and I'd remember a lot more things. That didn't motivate me for anything. I knew I had trouble with my drinking probably from my early 20s, because it was clear to me that drinking did something for me that it did not do for other people. Drinking was very important to me. So important that if I told other people how important it was, they'd do something to me. I knew that. So it became my secret. It also became my very best friend. And booze stuck with me when a lot of other things didn't. And we developed a very intimate relationship. I was someone who drank on a daily basis, and I thought I had a right to do that. And it was all mixed up with a lot of other things. The book talks about steps and things and encourages us to get involved in it. And I went to a lot of AA meetings when they would talk about steps. And I was, oh yeah, sure, you know, yes, I agree. I agree with those steps. I understand the concepts. I think they're nicely put together and clear. But I didn't do any of them. You know? And again, the reason I didn't do any of them is because the pain wasn't great enough. I have come to believe in the last few months that pain can be a great friend, because pain encourages me to change behavior that's killing me, and if it weren't for the pain, I wouldn't change. I didn't spontaneously come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was intervened on. Two friends of mine, both in the order, one I had known for over 10 years, the other for about 5 years, they sat me down and told me that I was in bad shape, and that was true, and that it was time to do something, and the time was now, and they checked out 3 hospitals. They all had good programs. I could check out those 3 hospitals and find out which one I wanted to go into, but I was going into one. Now, that terrified me, but I complied. I became very gracious to them. I became very afraid, and I figured, well, you know, course of least resistance. But inside, I was kind of relieved, enraged, embarrassed, felt awful, and was pretty convinced that my life was over. Because I couldn't imagine life without drinking. Also, I was 29 years old, and in the thought that the 20s were rough. I was a survivor, and I got through them, but they were real rough. And I kind of believed that the 30s would be worse. And, you know, cutting off the bottle as I was entering the 30s was proof to me that it is going to be nothing but downhill and very bleak. And I felt very sorry for myself. Anyway, I ended up going into a 21-day treatment program. The whole point of the program, I'm very grateful to them because I was not functional. I couldn't eat, and I couldn't wash, and I couldn't move. And this gave me a place to go, and food would be there, and washing was encouraged, and movement happened. So I was grateful for that. But before I went there, I did go to one AA meeting, because I asked my superiors, I said, well, why don't I try AA instead? And they said, why don't you try that too? Which really sounded awful. So I went to my first meeting. Now, I was not a grateful alcoholic. I was not glad to be there. I did not have a sense of home, companionship, and joy at my first meeting. There was a different sense there. I went to the old-timers meeting in Oakland on Friday night at 2910 Telegraph Avenue. Everybody in that room was 100,000 years old. And they were all short-haired, clean-shaven, tattooed, straight people. And it was real. I mean, you know, wearing socks and wearing, you know, cigarettes. Marlboro Box was the group cigarette, and Coffee Black was the group cigarette. And they all clearly held jobs and paid taxes. It was a very strange group of people. And I wandered into this bunch of folks, and I sat down there, and I did not know what to do next. just say, but the meeting started. I'm glad AA has its rituals. I mean, it just starts on time. And they started reading from this awful thing with 12 numbers on it. And I don't know if they asked for newcomers. I don't know if I responded. I was just kind of trying to figure out what's going on in this room, you know, and staring at them. And I grinned real wide. The reason I grinned real wise, I mean, you know, you can grin and be very hostile. This is my experience. And I also found that if you grin wide enough, long enough, they'll think you're on Thorazine. No one bothers you. Because I did not want best friends, phone numbers, rides, meeting directories, all this stuff. That I just leave me alone, please. I'm trying to sit in the chair. I went last year to one of my favorite meetings in Berkeley on Wednesday night on University Avenue, and we were sitting there, and the topic or the theme was, what do you hope to get out of sobriety? I love Berkeley topics. They're just so vague. And any one of them could be a doctoral dissertation. And we were in the meaning of meaning and the purpose of purpose and how it fits together, and yes. And we were all getting very philosophical. We had a new job, new relationship, change of behavior, change of pattern, better self-image, all that kind of stuff. And about 10 people into the share, someone raised their hand and said, my big hope is that I can stop shaking any day now. I understand that. I mean, I connected with him immediately, and I said, thank God someone in the room is speaking English in words that are clear, because it's all too easy for me to zip off into the stratosphere and try to figure this out one more time by myself in the room. And so I was sitting there in the chair, and people talked. The chair talked, and he was dull. There was a man next to him who said he had a real good week, and he finally cut the front lawn. I did not want what he had. Nor did I have a front lawn. Let's say that out loud. Right now I do. And I'm of the opinion, and it's only my opinion, that if you can do laundry and cut the front lawn on the same day, you get the mental health award for the month. That's real important stuff. Back to the meeting, it became my turn to talk, and I said, my name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, I think that was the first time I've ever said that to a group of people. I said that to myself a lot, in mirrors, you know, seeing the shrink, talking about my problem. And I'd repeating over and over, and Tom, you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. It never felt good. It never felt freeing. It never felt liberating. It felt kind of awful. It just felt like it was shameful and embarrassing, and like saying that you had this awful, hideous, deep leprosy. And all of a sudden I've been in rooms full of, you know, smaller meetings somewhere in Alameda County where it is someone's first meeting. And when they do get up and say, hello, my name is Fred, or my name is Jane, and all of a sudden everyone in the room just stops. Because we all know, if she could just say the word, the spell can start to be broken, you know? And all of a sudden they'll say, alcoholic. And we burst into wild applause. And we say, isn't it wonderful? We're so glad you're here. Did you use drugs too? Nice people don't do that, you know. We do that all the time, and it's just so. Well, I said my name was Tom, and I'm an alcoholic, and this was a Friday night meeting, and I said I haven't had a drink since Tuesday night. Now, footnote, it was beer. It was two pitchers of beer. It was two pitchers of beer in a pizza parlor in Santa Clara. I was with a supposed friend of mine, and I was telling him how everyone was ganging up on me, and they were trying to force me into treatment, and this is really unfair. This is an old drinking buddy of mine. And I said, I just hate it, and I don't know what to do. And he said, pardon the vulgarity, shit or get off the pot.
And I said, what does that mean? I never knew what that means. What are you talking about? And he said, I think you should go into treatment too. It's real scary then. You know, when the people who you think drank like you drank are telling you, when your bartender suggests treatment. It's scary. And I finished it. I did not get drunk at all. I mean, a vague buzz. But I couldn't get, I mean, you know, couldn't get drunk, couldn't quite get sober. Peed a lot, but in an appropriate place. And if I had known that was going to be my last drink, I would have done it very differently. Because I've heard great stories about people, you know, and they start drinking a little Jack Daniel's Rocks at the Fairmont Hotel and to go into a blackout and come out of it 6 months later, standing in a motel room in Rio de Janeiro with $600,000 worth of cocaine and a dead body in the room, you know? So they call AA.
Hey, hello.
I just haven't had to do that yet, you know? I just haven't had to do it yet. So I told them I had, so that was the drink, okay? And I told them I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night. These old, square, funny, bizarre people with whom I had nothing in common burst into applause. And the reason they burst into applause is because they understood what it means to not have a drink since Tuesday night. You know, and Earth people don't understand that. They don't know. And I felt not good, but hope. I felt some hope there. Hope is not my favorite feeling. Hope, and that comes from a lot of my own background. See, when I was going to the school as a small child, a lot of serious questions got discussed in third grade. And we talked about death on a regular basis. I think our teacher was a little depressed. Looking back on it, you know, clearly. But, you know, what happens when you die? And we were told, well, when you die, if you're real, 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 real good, you go directly to heaven. And this happened to Jesus and his mother. If on the other hand, you're really awful with no redeeming social values, when you die, you go right to hell. You do not pass go. You do not collect $200. It's pronto. All right. Well, then fine. We accept that. The question was, what happens to the 95% of us in the middle? You see, where do we go? Well, they said, it is only logical, it is only reasonable that there be a middle place to go. And that place was called purgatory. What was the difference? Next question. These are third graders. What's the difference between purgatory and hell? Well, hell is a place of fire and brimstone and anguish and loss and separation that goes on forever. While purgatory, on the other hand, is a place of fire and brimstone and anguish and suffering and pain that only goes on for 100 zillion years. So the difference is that in purgatory there is hope. Okay? That's what I mean about hope doesn't feel real good all the time. When I went to my first meeting, I did feel hope, but the hope was like this. As they were talking about their drivel, you know, I said, Tom, if you go to these meetings for the rest of your life, and if you never have another drink or joint or pill for as long as you live, and you're going to live to be real old. The hope was it wouldn't get worse. That was the hope. And in August of 1976, that seemed like a bargain. I would do whatever you people told me to do for as long as I had to do it if it just wouldn't get worse. The man next to me at the meeting explained 3 rules. I did not know that these weren't in the book. He didn't mention that either. But he said, we here at Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And we don't use no dope. Now, he didn't even say, we try not to, or see if you... He just, those were the rules. I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 years. You know, and I especially smoked it when I wasn't drinking, because that's when you had to smoke it. I mean, Tuesday night when I didn't drink, it was my first day without a drink, but I smoked dope that night, feeling very sorry for myself, and Wednesday night too, and Thursday night too, and I had every expectation of smoking dope Friday night. And I found out those three rules. And I was so stupid, I did not know you could leave if you didn't like those three rules. I figured if you show up at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 29, you do what they say. And so I just resolved to do that, and that became my program for over a year. I went to a lot of meetings. I don't know if I made 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, what I heard and what I didn't hear was very selective. But I went to a lot of meetings, and the reason I went to a lot of meetings was because I felt safe there. And safety is very big for me. I spent years terrified and very, very nutso, and I was convinced that paranoia was nothing but total awareness. And I had the CIA following me in my head and the FBI following me and psychopaths and weirdos and my phone being tapped. And it all existed right in here, but it sure was real and very spooky. Meetings were safe places. After going to a lot of meetings that were safe, and not all meetings were safe. San Francisco meetings were not safe. Not at all. They started at the wrong time. Different people were there. It made me nervous. Berkeley meetings were safe. Oakland meetings were safe. Even El Cerrito. But beyond that, it was Twilight Zone. And so I just stayed in that geographical area. And then I started finding more and more safety. I was a year sober and went to Los Angeles. I moved down there to work. And at a school that I worked at before. And I started trying to find small little intimate meetings. I went to a meeting on Sunday night on the corner of Wilshire and Normandy. It was called, I don't remember what it was called, but Wilshire Normandy Sunday night or something spiffy like that. And there were 500 of our closest friends there, and they all knew each other intimately, and I just stood in the back rigid with fear. I mean this, but I had no place else to go, you know? So, but then L.A. started becoming real safe. I mean, now I'm real safe in most places I go. But then I started finding safe people, and that brings up sponsorship, and I'll get back to sponsorship in a minute, because that's my first sponsor was the first safe person for me. And then I started finding other people I could be safe with. Dope and the three rules. I said those were my program for a long time, and I'd like to just reflect for a second on the fact that if you go to lots of meetings, don't drink and don't use, period, in a while you become what Al-Anons refer to as stark, raving, sober. Dry by the grace of God and the fellowship and grateful to be here, goddammit. It's when your friends start buying you booze, you know. Saying you really were a lot better human being drunk than you are sober. You know? At least when you were drinking, you'd pass out every so often. Right now, you're just awful to be with. And this gets us into tools of the program, which is a great big topic. There are lots of tools, slogans and meetings and directories and phone. I mean, there's lots of tools. I don't use all the tools all the time. I use the tools I need. And I know I need them when you remind me I need them. You see? Someone explained in the East Bay that the reason AA works is that we're not all crazy on the same day. But I've had some real crazy in my life. And this is a long recovery, giving retreats, talking to people, sponsoring people, you know, being quoted. And my life was going along just fine, I thought. I was living in Oakland again. I was going to a noon meeting at the Berkeley Fellowship. I rear-ended a woman who had just been fired from a job. Bad karma. Now, the reason I rear-ended her was it was only about 15 miles an hour, but she stopped and I didn't. I ran up to her and I was being total solicitation, generosity, kindness, and fairness, and I said, "Are you okay?" And with grit, she didn't even say hello or how are you. She said, "You better have insurance." Which I do, because I think it's God's will and state law. It's nice when they coincide. And I said, "I really do. And how are you okay?" And yes, but she was very upset and shaking. Her car had the tiny, tiny little dent. Mine is bleeding. The radiator is bleeding, pouring all over Shattuck Avenue. So here I am, with 35 years old, sober for 200 years, sponsoring people, reading the book, quoting. And I said, "Well, I know what we're supposed to do. Let's get our cars off the road." Right? We're dealing with an adult here. Got the car off the road, and then we exchanged license numbers, and we exchanged all those other things and insurance companies, and then I freeze. I don't know what to do next. We've gotten to where I've gotten before, and now it's all new. She's fine. She takes off. I notice my car is bleeding. It won't start. I freeze, and I can't remember what to do next. And I remember a meeting I attended in Los Angeles years before where a woman named Patricia was talking about having a flat tire on the Santa Monica Freeway. And her first response was suicide. And it occurred to her some days later that probably Earth people do not think of suicide immediately upon getting a flat tire. So if she's going to survive life's tragedies, she's going to have to find a buffer of some kind to get between the flat tire and the impulse to commit suicide. So she said, "I have to think a thought, some kind of mantra." And she said, "What I'm going to do is say, what would a normal person do in a circumstance like this?" Well, that conjured up nothing for her. Nothing. She doesn't know normal people. None of her husbands were normal people. You know, who are these Martians? And her next thought was, what would Nancy Reagan do in a circumstance like this? And that brought up a clear image. Nancy, number one, would call Ronnie, and number two, she'd call AAA. Well, there I was standing on the corner of Shattuck and Alcatraz, and all I could think of was, what would Nancy Reagan do in a circumstance like this? And I'm not speaking with Ronnie, but I had my AAA card, and I went and called AAA, and they said, "We'll be right there." They got me. They pulled me to Charlie's garage in Berkeley. Charlie was glad to see me, of course, money. And then I still had to get to this meeting, so I asked Mr. AAA man to drop me off at the Berkeley Fellowship, which he did. And I went in looking clearly disturbed. Seventh tradition, I reach for my wallet, it's gone. Maybe I left it at home. Then how did you have your AAA card? Good point. So I tried to track it down. Gone. Absolutely gone. Little money, but, you know, identification. I mentioned this at the Berkeley Fellowship, and one guy said, "Oh, whenever he lost his ID, he thought it was a sign from God to change his name." These are the people I associate. I feel completely normal with them. Yes, we understand each other. And I got home. I was living on an apartment on Telegraph Avenue next to the Pussycat Theater. And I went upstairs, and there's a letter waiting for me. And this letter is 2 pages, single-spaced typed, written by a priest in Southern California who I had an altercation with. We disagreed on some things. And this is a 2 pages, single-spaced type letter, not written to me, but to my superior. And it goes number and verse, pointing out every defective character that I had and some that he speculated on, but he was pretty close. And it was really an awful letter, just a hideous thing. And the last paragraph said, "I really have the best interests of only everybody at heart. Thank you very much." I carry that letter around with me for months, just in rage, and I'd show it to everyone and say, look at what this son of a bitch read me! Anyway, let's get back to that wonderful Wednesday. I ended up sitting in front of the television set, watching Sesame Street, eating ice cream out of the container. I did not know what else to do. My life was in shambles. And the thing that saved me is the telephone. I call a lot of people. They call back. Phone rang. Tom, how's your day? I told them. They'd say, have you canceled your credit card? My what? No. How do you do that? Why don't you do it now? Do it and call me back. So I did. 6 months later, I had a call from Visa, and they said, we just got a bill in that doesn't look like one of yours, but it could be. It's $1,100 at Ray's Liquor Store. Now, I actually felt relieved with that because my fear was it fell down a sewer. But instead, it's clear it's helping someone find the program, and it's just wonderful. I'm very glad. But the point being, I mean, I just literally, they told you, go and get a new driver's license, go to a meeting. What feelings are you feeling? Well, I didn't know what, I just felt shut down. But I was angry, real angry and real upset and kind of mean. And I just felt clumsy and awkward for days afterwards. This really rattled me. Well, this happens to me a lot. And this is why the steps aren't something I've done, thank you. The steps are things I do, because if I don't continue doing these, I will freeze. And once I freeze in my recovery, I'm just not good for very much. In November, I had a good case of hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And I was traveling in a whole bunch of places I don't care to go very much. And I was finally sitting in the Denver airport, and I was hungry, I was angry, I was lonely, I was tired, and my plane was late. And I sat next to this huge fat man who was smoking cigarettes without filters. And I looked over at him, and I just had this desire to crawl onto his lap and eat his cigarettes. Now, I didn't feel anything, but that was a fantasy, right? So I said, well, no, don't do that. That'll make him nervous. Instead, why don't you go and you can buy a carton. Notice a carton over there. All right. Now, I haven't had a cigarette in about 9 years, but it was real clear that this was a good idea for a few moments. And then I got from a carton to a pack, and then I mentioned, well, I was non-smoking, it would just be inconvenient. And then, listen, if you want to do this, you can do it tomorrow, which is another tool I use a lot. If I just can give myself a little time, I can remember to put some stuff off until tomorrow. So the smoking thing passed. About 18 seconds later, my brain said, that's a very attractive bar. And a brandy and soda is a very attractive drink. And you're in a foreign state. This shouldn't count. No one would know. This is 11 years of... No one will know. And I knew I can't argue with that voice. So I just say, I can always do it tomorrow morning. You know, let's just put that off. And then about 18 seconds later, the thought was you could go to the men's room and hang yourself. That's when it occurred to me that there was something going on. See, usually the fantasy is to run away from home, to smoke, drink, or commit suicide. But I had already run away from home. I was in Denver. So the other three... But what happens when that's going on inside of me is there's clearly something going on inside of me that I don't want to deal with. Because I want to be gone somehow. I want to get out of the skin. And so I have to take... And I discovered, much to my embarrassment, because I should be better by now, that I had gotten myself into a position where I was real hungry. I was eating lousy. I was real angry about very important things. I hadn't connected with people I love. I've been so busy. And I'd been so busy, I was just exhausted. You know, just this side of brain dead. And... When I got home, I knew I have to do something about this now. Or it's going to come back again a lot stronger and again a lot stronger, and then who knows what's going to happen. I didn't have a lot of difficulty with the first step. I'm pretty aware of the fact that my life is unmanageable. I mean, and it's still true. I'm amazed I show up anywhere. I get confused and lost and mix up dates the unmanageability was not my problem. It was a keen insight of mine that it was pretty grim. The hard thing for me was step two. Why is that? Well, it's because step two says I can get well. Step two says that I can heal. And I never believed that. I never believed. I believed in a God who was wonderful, compassionate, and loving. I was taught that in school. I really was. And I went to Catholic school. So, you know, I don't know how I was the only person who heard that. But I was one of those people who heard it. And God was really wonderful. But I knew that all of God's wonderfulness did not apply to me. See, I mean, for some reason, I was the exception to the rule. And whereas God's grace would work for you, God's grace would not work for me. So I just accepted despair as a pretty normal thing. You know, the doom. We will never get better. It's all grinding to a halt. I thought that if you weren't depressed, you weren't paying attention. And I was afraid that if I took the second step, I would turn into a kind of Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. And I saw people like that on the program. I saw people who were grateful. And again, remember, I wasn't real glad to be here. Now, I was real glad I wasn't out there. But we had a woman in Berkeley. She died sober, but she died about 2 or 3 years sober. An older woman, and she died as a result of her drinking. Her insides never really recovered. And she was sick a lot, and Mary P. And whenever, we'd go to meetings together a lot, and whenever they called on her to speak, she would say, I'm so grateful for this program, and I'm so grateful for the steps, and I'm so grateful for the fellowship, and as long as I keep coming to meetings, there's love in my life. And I just thought she was brain damaged. I said, this woman has had one quart too much. She doesn't understand how grim it really is. So when I talk with her, I talk with her like I was talking to a slow child. You know, how are you, Mary? Nice to see you. But knowing that she had nothing to say to me about anything. Now, the reason was because I was so full of rage and hate and anger. I couldn't hear her. I was sober over a year. I went down to L.A., moved there, went out to a meeting in the San Fernando Valley, and it was a huge meeting and a lot of people in the room, and I sat way in the back because I can judge more easily from way in the back. And this guy got up to talk. I don't know what his name was. He was a middle-aged Caucasian male. That's all I remember, kind of tall. And he said, I'm not grateful that I'm an alcoholic, but I'm real grateful that you are. Now, that had never occurred to me, but it was true. I mean, I was very grateful that women and men like you were in rooms like these that I could come to and just feel awful. And that was the first quiver of gratitude that I had about my recovery. And it wasn't gratitude about my recovery, it was gratitude about yours. And that spread. I was in a meeting in Berkeley, and I one evening looked around the room and noticed that I was not the only person in the room. This was amazing to me. And it also occurred to me that everybody in the room had a right to be there. And I was in the room. And I had a right to be there too. And if I was there, there was a chance for God's grace to work on me too. I mean, it seems like a little bit of tortuous reasoning, But that's what I had to do to realize that step two could work. And well, what if step two wouldn't work? Well, I could take it anyway. I didn't question God's power as much as I questioned my willingness to change. Because I didn't like the way I was, but at least I knew the way I was. And if you said, Tom, tell me who you are, I'd tell you, and I'd list everybody I hated. And every cause I ever fought for that lost. And I would list people who were awful and disgusting and loathsome, and I could just resurrect whole things that happened 20 years ago and describe them in detail, and that's who I was. And people started saying things like, get rid of resentments, get rid of old fears. And the visual image I had inside my head was that if I did that, there would be nothing left. I would be completely empty. I'd be like a rice hull blowing around the room. And I did not find that attractive. And step two is very wrapped up in this, because if I become willing to heal, an awful lot of things that I'm very familiar with are going to be let go of. And I resisted that a lot. And I finally, it was pain. And the pain was so great that I became willing to let God, whatever God looks like, change however God wants to change me. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I'm real glad that step says came to believe and does not say came to feel. Because my experience with feelings is they come and go. And there are times I feel God's presence, and there are times I feel God's absence. This does not mean God has gone away. I'm still conscious, an awareness of God's presence, even if I'm not feeling it at the moment. I think faith is a very big experience, and it's one of those words we use a lot. But there are a variety of ways of believing. I'm not just talking about denominations and churches and things. I'm talking about that experience of faith. And for some of us, the faith experience is walking into a well-lit room. You know, we've been living in the darkness, and we suddenly find a clean, well-lighted place, and we go and do it, and everything falls into place, and it's sweet. All answers are solved. All problems are, you know, it's just grand, and it feels splendid. Well, that's valid, and I've had those experiences. But it's also true for me that there are times when I'm outside, and it's pretty light, and I can see things, and I walk by this dark room, and there's a voice that comes out of the dark room, and it says, Tom,
come on in.
And I don't respond immediately by saying, I'd love to. My first question is, who are you? Number two, why do you want me? Number three, what else is in the room? I mean, I'd like stuff known before I'd make a move. And my getting sober was just like that. I didn't know what sobriety was going to look like, and I inched my way into it until my eyes kind of got used to the room, and I found out it wasn't so bad, and I kind of relaxed, and then there would be this other dark door, and the voice saying, you're not in the room yet. Come on in. We're going to go in further. And it's kind of a faith walking in darkness. You know? And that's also a regular experience of faith for me. That I don't know the future, I don't know what's going to happen next, I have no guarantees. But if I go to meetings, don't drink, don't use, there's hope. And go through that. You know? I mean, I'm more than willing to do God's will if I know what God's will is. That's not true. Sometimes I'm willing to do God's will when I know what God... Sometimes I just say, I'd rather not. You know, please. Haven't we had enough to do with each other this year? And my fear of God, my fear of letting go and trusting this God is that I'm always afraid that God will ask more. And I just say, you know, I gave it the office. Can't we do something else? And it's this turning it over and a regular surrendering. And I say, listen, I've already surrendered, and there's more to surrender. And I don't know what happens yet. A good friend of mine has just been diagnosed with AIDS. He's been sober 11 years. We've spent a lot of time together. We've worked together. And he's entering a real dark room. And he's handling this much better than I am. You know, because I feel anger and rage and how come and why, and it's not fair. And he says, I'm trusting God on this one. You know? Well, I'm glad for him. But when I cross over to the other side and meet God, I've got some questions that I'd like answered. Because the way I see my relationship with God, it's not this, you know, walking hand in hand with the creator of, you know, sometimes, yes, sometimes that's true. You know, that contact, the energy's flowing, we're together, ain't it grand? Other times, though, I really sense that it's a tug of war. And I'm on one side and God's on the other, and it's just back and forth and back and forth, and I just resist. And I was trying to explain this to my sponsor. And as you know, when you talk to your sponsor, you have to speak very slowly. Use small words. And he pointed out to me that my pain was not from God changing things. My pain was from my resistance to God changing things. And I have lots of resistance. There's a Greek writer named Nikos Katsenzakis. He may have won the Nobel Prize, I'm not sure. But one of the books he wrote was Zorba the Greek, which is a wonderful story of insanity and life. But in his autobiography called Report to Greco, he writes about when he was a very young man, he wanted a lot of answers. You know, as every 19-year-old does, answers for everything. So he went to the oldest monastery in Greece. He was Greek Orthodox. And went to the oldest monk in the oldest monastery and said, "Old man, explain this to me. Tell me everything. What does it mean?" And the old man said, "Well, I divide my life in half. First half of my life, I wrestled with the devil." And Katsenzakis said, "What happened?" And the old man said, "I won." And Katsenzakis said, "Well, now what are you doing?" And he said, "Now I'm wrestling with God." And Katsenzakis said, "Why?" And the old man said, "Because I hope I'll lose." You know, I mean, that makes sense to me. And I'm sure God understands the process a lot better than I do. My recovery is not linear. You know, today is better than yesterday, which is better than the day before. That's not the story of my life. I'm not one of those people who believe that my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. I just don't believe that. I had some great times drinking, and I've had some awful times sober. As one of the women in the East Bay says, when you get sober, you feel better, you feel everything better. And there are some times, you know, sober people with good program go through grief and go through death and go through job losses and relationships breaking up. We go through lots of stuff, and the program gives us tools to walk through those sober. You know, it's not like, well, now I'm in the program, I'm no longer going to hurt, or I'm no longer going to feel, or I'm no longer going to have bad days. We have all of those with tools to use. That wasn't the point. The point was, oh, isn't this embarrassing? Just the last whole set of brain cells just went. Hold on. Used to happen to me in the classroom, too. Where was I? My recovery is not linear. It's circular. And it kind of runs in a spiral. And it kind of goes like this. And there are some places I regularly come back to visit. And it doesn't mean that I didn't work it through last time. It means I just get to work it through again. But from a different angle. Like one of the things I regularly have a little tension with are like authority figures. You know, meter maids, the President of the United States, my father, the Pope. Authority figures. And there are times I'm at absolute peace and serenity with them, and there are other times all they have to do is open their mouths and I have to call my sponsor and say, "What on earth do I do? Did you just see what this jerk just did?" And he explained Al-Anon to me. It's very hard. Letting go. I wanna end up. I hope I continue to learn things. And again, pain helps me learn things. I went to a meeting a few weeks ago, and I had some craziness going on. I was feeling kind of vulnerable and uncomfortable and overreacting to things. And a fellow at the meeting said that in his recovery, what he has tried to learn how to do is he says, avoid the behavior that leads you to despair. He said, that's the secret. If we could just learn to avoid the behavior that leads us to despair, we can live happy, real human lives. I still have behavior that leads me to despair, and bit by bit, it changes. About 5 years ago, I took a class from the Orthodox Rabbi of Berkeley. This was, I was interested in Judaism, figuring anything I learn about Judaism, I learn about my own denomination, being we're so intimately connected. He was a wise man and a good teacher. And I don't know what you know about rabbis, but rabbis rarely answer direct questions with direct answers. That doesn't help anybody think. So what you want to do is throw questions back to people. Like, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? A good rabbi would say, whose picture is on the coin? Caesar's. Give it to him. Next. What is the greatest commandment? 10 commandments, 613 laws. You know, what is the greatest of all the laws? A good rabbi would say, you're a lawyer. How do you read it? Well, you're to love the Lord your God with all your heart and strength and mind and soul, and your neighbor as yourself. Footnote. Some point out that the reason for most of our grief is that most of us do love our neighbors just like ourselves. Text resumed. The rabbi would say, you got it right. You know, don't need to ask me. And then the lawyer said, well, who's my neighbor? Now, if you can't answer with a question, you tell a story. See? A man is going on the road to Jericho and falls in among robbers. You see? And then you end the story with a question. And the question was, now, who was neighbor to the man? And the lawyer said, the one that showed compassion. And the rabbi said, you got it. You know, go do that a lot. I saw that exact same process happening in Berkeley a few years ago. We were in the class, and the class was for two groups of people. One were people who were born Jewish but had never done anything about it. So it was roots time. And the other were people who were converting to Judaism, and then there was me. And I was, the rabbi knew I was a priest, and we talked, you know, professional shop talk a couple times. He was an older man by a full generation. He treated me with great respect, and whenever a quick question about Christianity came up in the class, he deferred to me. Well, and the fact was, he frequently knew more about it than I did. I mean, this was a very wise man. So, he's teaching a class. Someone says, Rabbi, what's a blessing? And the rabbi stopped for a moment and fooled with his beard, which is why we have beards. And said, when God created the world, God created the world in 6 days. And at the end of each day of creation, God looked at what God had made and said, this is good. This is good. So God creates the dry land out of the chaos and says it's good, and creates sun and moon and stars and says they're good, and creates goats and fish and avocados and things, says they're good. And on the 6th day, God creates the human being and doesn't say anything. And the rabbi said, any conclusions? And someone in the class said, people are no good. And the rabbi said, that's a possible conclusion. And that's why, he said, it's a very bad translation. He said, in English, good means too many things. You have good days and have a good day and a good book and B good book and a good person and a good meal and for a good time call. You know, a lot of meanings. He said, in Hebrew, and then he looked over at me and said, which is what God spoke. He said, God looked at what God had made and said, this is Tov.
Tov, T-O-V. And he says, what does Tov mean? He says, Tov means something is whole. Tov means something is complete. Tov means something is exactly the way it's supposed to be. It can't be any different. The rabbi said, the land is created Tov. The sun and the moon and the stars are created Tov. Fish and goats and cows and sheep and avocados are Tov. But he said, people are not created complete. We're created with lots of empty places, lots of holes. And in the course of a lifetime, what we're supposed to do is fill in some of those holes and rub smooth some of those empty, jagged edges. We're born male, we're supposed to turn into men. We're born female, we're supposed to turn into women. We're born male, female, we're supposed to turn into human beings. And the rabbi said, as we travel life's road, as we do things, as we grow, as we're on journey, as we're on pilgrimage, anything that gets behind us and pushes us forward, anything that gets in front of us and drags us ahead, anything that gets down deep inside of us where it's dark and cold and brittle and kicks and shoves and elbows until suddenly there's room for light and air, the rabbi said, anything that does that is a blessing. And he said, lots of times blessings don't feel good, and lots of times we don't know their blessings till years later, when we've run across a situation that we knew was going to kill us, and instead it opened up doors that we never even knew were there. When he said that, I got a whole new understanding of how, because of women and men like you, and rooms like these, alcoholism, which was a curse, has become the greatest blessing in my life. It's a real privilege to be here this weekend. I'm real glad to be here and to feel connected with you, and I'm grateful to the committee for asking me to come and for showing the graciousness and the hospitality that Sacramento is known for. Thank you.